Hello and welcome to Object Matters, the podcast of the Chow Chak Wing Museum at the University of Sydney. My name's Craig Barker and I'm the Head of Public Engagement at the Chow Chak Wing Museum. And the whole aim of this podcast series, Object Matters, is to explore with our guest each episode their personal connection with one of the items in the collection. So I'm really excited this particular episode to be joined by a friend and colleague, Nicholas Krogan. Nick is an art historian and works with the Power Institute as the Program and Events Coordinator. Nick, thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
So, look, obviously I'm going to preempt our conversation by guessing that you're going to be discussing a work of the modern and contemporary art collection. But before we get to it, can you talk a bit about your own background as an art historian, your own research interests, and how you got into the subject?
I'm an art historian. I'm also a writer and an editor, and have written and edited publications around modern contemporary art for quite a number of years. My interest in art history is in the kind of longer history of art's relationship to technology and to politics. And that's taken me to areas like the history of photography, the history of cinema. And my PhD research, which I'm finishing at the moment, is on the history of portable video, which came to consumers in the late 60s in the United States and was seized upon as a really revolutionary tool for artists and activists and architects. And so it's that kind of utopian moment for video that's my thesis is about. Yeah. And it's also the utopianism that has drawn me to the work that we're going to talk about in a moment.
So yeah, before we get to that, just with the PhD, I mean, I'm really intrigued because, of course, video is a technology which has now been largely superseded. So how do you find, A, in terms of looking back 50, 60 years, A, how the artists now look back on the work that they did when they were younger in that material, but also issues of preservation and conservation and long-term lifespan of it?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, when we use the term video today generally or in the context of art, it has a very amorphous general meaning. It can sometimes just mean moving image work. But back in the late 60s and early 70s, it was a pretty new concept and it meant something quite specific. It meant a technology that had been available since the 50s, the idea of recording sound and images on magnetic tape. But it was only in the 60s that you as a consumer could buy technology. Yeah. And so video at this point meant video camera being attached to a transportable tape recorder.
Yep.
They were initially open reel, in fact.
Yeah.
So this was even before cassette tapes were invented.
Yeah.
And it also meant the ability to feedback. That is, you could videotape someone and you could show them straight away what you'd just videoed, which was different to film. Mm. And that was sort of an important contextual thing because video was not television and it was not film. Mm. And a number of the artists and activists who were working around the time really insisted on that difference. It was not the same as mainstream broadcast television because video was about bringing that power back to the people in line with the kind of revolutionary politics of the moment. And it was not film because with film you had to send it away to get developed. It was quite expensive. Mm. It also had this slightly longer history.
Mm.
Video was fresh and new. You didn't need to send it away. It was cheaper. It was transportable.
The editing process as well, whereas most films, even within art house cinema, there was some degree of narrative being developed, whereas this gave the artists the freedom of not needing to edit, that they could capture the moment.
Yeah, and initially one couldn't edit, in fact. So in the first couple of years when video technology kind of came on the market, editing was pretty much impossible to do. So you see over the course of the 70s, a number of different technologies being invented to do things like editing or to introduce color or to a number of the artists that I write about invented what they called video synthesizers, which were ways of these sort of vast machines, almost like computers, that were enabled you to kind of feed different color and feedback patterns into the videotape. And so video became this very unstable kind of technological entity in the 70s. And it was really only by the end of the decade into the 80s that cassettes were invented and the videotape industry really took hold of it and tied it back into the film industry.
Yeah, right.
And it's a lot of its sort of revolutionary potential kind of got dissipated lost at that moment. Yeah. So the 70s, and that's what attracts me to it, remains this moment where video was kind of held this utopian potential of a different way of thinking about images or technology and people's relationship to them that by the 80s seemed foolhardy or impossible, but at the time was really genuinely felt.
Yeah. Well, now, interestingly, talking about the chronological and contextual framework of the time of your doctoral research, it segues very nicely into the time of the establishment of the Power Institute and the power collection more broadly. So as someone who works with the Power Institute, could you take our listeners through what the Power Institute represents and the work that you are doing collectively? And I might then ask you to talk a bit about JW Power and the power bequest more broadly.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, I'm the events and programs officer at Power Institute, and the Power Institute is, you know, in practice connected to the Department of Art History at the University of Sydney, but we are in fact our own foundation. And in short, what do we do? Well, we organize public programs. It's my role. We publish books about art and art history and visual culture. And we also maintain a number of support infrastructure elements for researchers in the arts. So we have a residency in Paris that we've just actually announced an open call for. We distribute prizes in various categories. A key part of the Power Institute is the Schaefer Library, which is one of Australia's most important collections of art history and art books. So we sort of do a range of things. And that was a consequence of the power bequest, which was an amount of money that was left by an artist whose name was J.W. Power to the University of Sydney with a very broad remit for bringing art, ideas and research to the people of Australia. And so that mission, that bequest was announced in the 60s, in the early 60s. And the mission of the task of fulfilling that mission has been deployed in different ways. So there's a power collection of art, which was collected over the 60s and 70s and then went on to become the Museum of Contemporary Art in Sydney, which not a lot of people know.
No. It's a bit of a hidden, without that knowledge, most people are blissfully unaware of that connection between the University of Sydney and the Museum of Contemporary Art.
Yeah, and that collection, of course, is sort of now coming back to the university and is on display now at the Chow-Chak Wing Museum. The Power Publications has been part of that. The Power Bequest also helped found the Department of Art History. And, yeah, so it's been it's had a really lasting and meaningful impact on the arts in Australia, particularly in a country where private philanthropy of the arts in such a broad-minded way is rare.
Yeah, and particularly in the early 60s as well, when the initial bequest was made.
Yeah, certainly.
So Power's bequest was very much written in terms of this idea of, for the betterment of the broader Australian community, an understanding of what was happening internationally in terms of art. So within the Power collection and the artwork that you've selected today, and we'll get to in a second, do you think that it fulfilled that desire to allow Australians access to a whole range of different ideas and concepts that were taking place in the art during that time of the formation of the collection?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. I mean, J.W. Power himself, as I said, was an artist, and he was, you know, although born in Australia, he moved overseas and spent most of his time overseas in Europe, and in that context became part of the kind of interwar avant-garde scene. So his call to sort of bring the best ideas in art and visual culture to the people of Australia was, you know, speaking from that traditional centre of art Europe and bringing those ideas to a sort of the supposedly kind of remote backwaters of Australia, which is a dynamic that has played out in lots of different ways throughout Australian art history. I'm definitely not the best person to talk about the history of Power. I mean, one of the foremost scholars on his work and life is Anne Stephen, who's a curator here.
And, of course, he's done an episode within the podcast series, the Object Matters series, specifically about one of Power's stunning works. But yeah, you are right.
And also the director of the Power Institute, Mark Ledbury, also knows this history very well. But I will say that it's a In fact, we are looking into the Power Archives now to sort of look at different ways we might tell this story, and different ways that that very broad mission of bringing sort of best ideas and research around art and visual culture, how that has manifested at different times in history, as, you know, from the 60s to the present, the dominant idea framings of art and art history have shifted from modernism, postmodernism, contemporary art. Power has sort of, in the books that it's published and the scholars that it has brought to Australia, has entangled itself with that history in really interesting ways.
So I guess let's jump into the Power Collection then. Can you describe the work that you have selected for this particular episode?
So I'm like to speak about a work by an American artist, a North American artist called Alan Sonfist. And the work is called Crystalline Enclosure from 1970. And it's a work that I had the pleasure of writing about for the catalogue of the Light and Darkness exhibition at Ann Stephen's kind invitation. And it was a really fun task to write and research about this work because it intersects in interesting ways with my thesis research.
I must say, and not meaning to blow smoke up you or anything like that, but it was an enjoyable read as well. I learned a lot from reading it. But Sonfist himself as an artist, because he is still alive.
Yes.
But when was the period in which he was practicing, and how does this work fit into his broader body of work?
Yeah, so I mean, it's actually, you know, this work comes from an extremely interesting period in his artistic trajectory, and it's really great that the Power Collection contains this work. He only made a few of them. And they were shown first in early 1970s and in his first solo exhibition, in fact. That's in the Power Collection was shown in his very first solo show in New York. And so it's early in his career. Sonfist had trained as a painter in the 1960s as many artists of his generation had, painting in, you know, the 40s and 50s in the United States being the dominant way of saying something meaningful in art. But by the late 60s, he had decided to chuck it in. He was done with painting. And again, that was the sort of dominant trend in kind of avant-garde art at that time, that artists were sick of the dominance of abstract expressionist painting, and indeed were trying to move away from art objects of all kinds, not just painting, but also sculpture. And instead they were interested in not objects, but processes. How you use art to show process rather than an object. And they were interested in performance and happenings. And New York was a kind of epicenter for this kind of work. So artists that had, like Sonfist, had a background in painting, suddenly found themselves working with, in Sonfist's case, he was working with microorganisms, he was working with plants, and he was working with crystals, hence this work.
Well, I'll get you to describe Crystalline Encounters for our listeners who may not have had a chance to either see it in the exhibition yet or to see images of it. How would you describe the work?
It's an interesting work to describe from the point of view of an art historian. To describe the work, having researched it, it gives you a sort of different type of insight into what's going on that you would not necessarily gain from looking at it. Looking at the work, what you see is a rather large spherical glass enclosure that has a kind of purpley hue to it. And that
it looks a bit like a light bulb, doesn't it, in terms of its shape?
And it has some sort of crystal that seems to be kind of congealed on the inside of the sort of glass globe. What's going on here is, in fact, and what Sonfist wanted us to see in this work was not just an object, just a beautiful object, which it is, it's quite alluring, but a process. So what's going on with this work is, inside this specially constructed glass globe, there is a chemical compound that is collects as a solid kind of grain at the bottom of the globe. And as it heats up, it sublimes, as in it turns into a kind of gas that then floats into the body of the globe. And then as a gas attaches itself, eventually kind of attaches to the sides of the globe, wherein it cools down again and crystallizes into these shapes that we see on the side of the glass. And then that builds up and inevitably falls back into the base of the sculpture where in the process starts again. So what you see when you see these kind of intricate patterns on the outside of the globe are the traces of a process that would otherwise be invisible. Of course, we can't see the gas, the compound turning into a gas, and we can't see the gas floating up into the globe. But the presence of the glass allows us to see that process made visible for a second. And that's what Sonfist was interested in. He was interested in, like a number of other artists at the time, making visible things that we couldn't in our everyday visual experience see.
I mean, I'm also intrigued by the idea, too, that the work itself as we view it in 2022 is very different to how it must have looked during the solo show in 1970, just through that process as well, so that the work continues to evolve and change. And often, of course, the general assumption about galleries and museums, of course, is that these are places where everything is static and doesn't change. So the very fact that the work itself has built in this process of change is quite exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, Sonfist's point is really just to alert us to the fact that this change is constantly happening, and that the artwork really is just a means of making that visible. The real subject of his artwork is the environmental process of solids turning into gases, turning into solids again, which of course is not contained by the museum in any way, really.
But all encased within this beautiful, beautiful container in terms of the glass sphere.
Yeah, and so you can think of it in a way as, you know, thinking of Sonfist's background as a painter and the sort of really complex thinking about abstract painting that was happening in the US in the 50s and 60s. You know, we could think of it as an abstract work, an abstract painting. Kind of crystalline structures that you see. But, of course, the difference is that this is an abstract work that's infinitely complex and constantly changing.
Yeah.
And that tells you a lot about the changes in art in North America.
At the time.
In the 60s,
Have you found, both in terms of your research but also in conversations with him, that, you know, did he spend a lot of time studying the scientific processes in terms of how he was going to incorporate it? Or, you know, what came first, the idea and then matching the science, or did he understand the science and then think, how can I encapsulate that within a work? Do you know?
Well, in terms of the science of the chemical science of the work, my impression is that that is actually not of a lot of interest to Sonfist. as long as it could do the work of the transformation and process of solid to gas, solid again.
The
two things that Sonfist was interested in, that this allowed him to engage with, was, on the one hand, he was interested in the environment and, you know, what that meant in the late 1960s, early 1970s in the US was, you know, quite particular. It meant, first of all, the modern environment movement, which was, you know, just emerging at that time. In fact, just before he showed this work in 1970, for the first time, he participated in the very first Earth Day. Which was a sort of huge deal in New York City. And so there was sort of the emergence of an environment movement that was no longer just about protecting a kind of capital in nature that lay over there that was associated with wilderness and this very sort of 19th century romantic idea. It was an environment movement that was concerned about things like pollution.
And the Clean Air Act that Nixon administration passed as well.
And was thinking about the environment not as something over there, but something that was entangled with our everyday lives, and a really, you know, perceived crisis that human practices of industrialism were unsustainable and were going to lead to some kind of cataclysmic endpoint, which. We still live in that moment.
Yes. We haven't learned, really, have we?
Yeah, and the other facet of that moment environmentally was the sort of emergence of a science of ecology, which again was also thinking about the ways in which ecological processes are deeply entangled with each other. And so Sonfist was interested in that. He was interested in how do you engage an audience to think about the environment in a new, more kind of ecological way. Right. The other thing he was interested in was vision, seeing itself. And, you know, that came in part from a brief period of training he had earlier in the 60s with an art teacher called Hoyt Sherman, who was kind of known for this practice he did with his art students, which included Sonfist, of a flash lab, which is quite a kind of interesting thing. He created this environment in the dark where he would sit his students down with pads and paper, and he would flash images, slides up for microseconds.
Yes, yeah.
And then his students would have to draw what they saw.
Oh, wow.
And the idea was that by doing that, you don't have time to conceptualize what you've seen. And all you can draw on is a kind of quote-unquote pure aesthetic experience, which sort of is left as a kind of after image on your eye.
Yeah.
So it's the idea of sort of returning to some kind of originary visual process that's untainted by ideas.
Mm.
And so Sonfist kind of joined these two sort of interests in vision on the one hand and ecology on the other to solve a problem which he kind of wrote about in his writings, which was that the longer history of industrialism for Sonfist was about humans dominating nature, and that this relationship of domination had separated humans from nature so much so that they couldn't even see nature anymore, nor could they see their own entanglement with it. So his task was, how do we help people see nature anew? And that, to him, was sort of, that was part of his environmental politics.
Yeah, right.
And that's the utopian gesture of this work.
Yeah, right.
Is it tries to make us see ecological processes happening. And an important detail that makes this work really representative of this period in Sonfist's work is that the heating of the chemical compound in the sculpture is connected to our presence in the room and our body heat and so on in likely a fairly minuscule way. But nonetheless, point is that for Sonfist is that our presence as viewers is implicated in this process. Yeah. So it's not that separation of nature and humans that Sonfist believed that was a consequence of industrialism.
That's really quite fascinating. But that initial solo show in which the Crystalline Encounters work was first exhibited back in 1970, how was it received by his contemporaries?
So it was a small show, and it was his first solo show. So it didn't get huge coverage, but those that did see it and reviewed it in the art press at the time, I think, recognized what was going on and recognized, at least in part, that kind of those intentions that I was just discussing.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's in part because it was recognizable at that moment. Sonfist was by no means the only artist trying exploring to visualize process.
Yeah.
It was the sort of height of the late 60s kind of political moment. As I said, Earth Day had been only a couple of months before. So if you were living in New York, part of the art world, these kind of ideas would have been legible. And in fact, you know, today when we look back at Sonfist's work, he's often folded into a narrative of environment art or land art, which is a sort of category that we might associate with artists like Robert Smithson or Walter de Maria. And I actually think that's wrong. I think that that's not the best way to think about what his work was doing, because one way to see those large-scale environmental artworks is as kind of interventions into nature, interventions into the landscape, whereas Sonfist was not trying to intervene into nature. Rather, he was interested in the question of vision and how do we learn to see the environment in a new way. And, you know, that history and that intention plays out when, you know, later the same year, he becomes involved with the Center for Advanced Visual Studies, which is a kind of center at MIT in Boston, headed up by Georgi Kepej, who was an artist who had set up the center. And he is, you know, led this center for a number of years and was kind of central to the discussion around art and technology and science.
Mm.
And, you know, I think that world is where Sonfist's work
belongs.
belongs and makes most sense.
And what about his later career, the work he was doing later in the 70s and 80s and beyond? I mean, was he continuing to explore that relationship with that visual aspect? Did he continue to explore the environment, or did he move on to new themes and new ideas?
Yeah, his work remains engaged with the environment. By sort of the mid-1970s, he becomes more interested, I would say, in the kind of the personal. Yeah. And the idea of memory and personal history, which is a challenge for a researcher of his work, yeah. because he begins to constantly work with his own biography and tell histories and stories of his own biography that yeah. are like not always accurate, or you know. So he's playing with things. So it's very hard to pin down dates of things that happen because he's deliberately fabricating things sometimes.
Does he revisit, you know, in his writings the Crystalline Encounters work or the work of that solo show? Does he refer back to it, or
not
is it
so much?
I've moved on now.
Yeah, not so much. I mean, I think there is a break in his work in the kind of mid-70s period where he becomes interested in the personal and memory, but he also becomes very invested in public art works.
Yep.
And the sort of scale of his practice shifts dramatically. Yep. And the work he's best known for now are kind of large-scale public artworks.
Yep.
And which is why I think the work that we have in the Light and Darkness show is such a great part of the collection, because it represents that earlier part of his career. And I should mention as well that Georgi Kepej, who headed up the Center for Advanced Visual Study, also owned one of these.
Oh, really?
Enclosures. Yeah, apparently had it on his desk. Yeah.
Well, I guess that segues quite nicely into how did this work get from a New York artist studio to Sydney? What was the process by which it was acquired into the Power Collection, and how did it fit with the broader collecting policies of the Power Collection at the time?
Yeah, I mean, it was a bit of an inspired purchase. And a lot of the work, I think, that's in the Light and Darkness show that Anne Steven and Katrina LeBrew have pulled together for this show demonstrates that there were some really interesting purchases made for the collection that weren't necessarily particularly cool at the time, but are now returning, certainly within the field of art history, as being really of immense interest. So this is kinetic art, like Michael calls kinetic art or op art, art that's about kind of movement and light and playing with the viewer's kind of perceptual apparatus. So, how was this work purchased? Someone from the Power Institute went to this show and bought it. And there's some correspondence in the archives about shipping it from New York to Sydney without breaking it. There was an ongoing relationship in the sense that there is another work by Sundqvist in collection, which is also hanging upstairs still. Which is, more of a kind of public or larger scale work, let's say.
And but because that's a work from the early 1980s, so an evolution, a demonstration of the evolution of his own work, isn't it?
Exactly,
Because the other piece we're referring to is the Soils of Sydney. That was created when he participated in the Sydney Biennale. You're listening to Object Matters, the podcast of the Chow Chak Wing Museum. My guest this episode is Nicholas Crawley. Nick, one of the whole points of this episode is to talk about that personal relationship between us and the item in the collection that we're reviewing. From your perspective, and in terms of both your career in art history and art research, but also given your doctoral research fits within this time period as well, what is your relationship with this particular piece? Does it move you? Does it inspire you? Does it frustrate you?
I think, because it's because I am an art historian and I've researched it, it's my relationship with artworks is always fraught. It's always bound up with the trauma of writing and research.
It's not the same that the typical viewer has when they see an artwork, I guess.
I think what I love about this work and what I have always enjoyed with art and why I study art history is that it's not so much an object in itself that impacts or affects me. It's that it is the trace of something bigger. And it's, most immediately this work is about that. It's a trace of a particular process that's happening. But it's also a trace of a particular moment in time, a particular moment in environmental history and politics, and a particular moment in our understanding of how vision works.
Yep.
And a particular one particular person, Alan Sonfist's, grappling with that. very complicated moment in history and to try to sort of distill it down to a single object that we can encounter in a glance. And that's sort of, that's like magic, I think. And that's the best artworks do that for us.
Wonderful way of presenting it, actually. I mean, that's a great way of thinking about it. And I guess it also fits very nicely within the overall themes of the Light and Darkness exhibition that's currently exhibited in that same manner, isn't it? That it's very representational, isn't it?
Yeah, not so much, I guess, representational of a history, but it's a kind of, it's a trace of a moment in of a very particular moment in time. And it's a, it's a cipher for that moment. That it's kind of, it allows you an entry point that at first seems quite simple, which is standing in front of this object and admiring that it looks cool.
Yeah.
And through that entry point, you can then get access to this very particular story about New York in 1970.
Yeah. The question I ask everyone who appears on the episode is to choose one word, any word from the English language that sums up this work for you. Is there any word that springs to your mind?
Let's go with trace.
Trace is good, actually.
Trace.
Yeah. I liked cipher too before, for what it's worth, but it's your word, not mine.
Well, I think possibly this, the word cipher might come from one of my art history mentors, which is the art historian Charles Green, who taught me when I was an undergrad. But yeah, trace, because it's a trace of that moment, as I was mentioning, but it also speaks to a kind of that process of trace making, which, you know, the history of art and technology in the 19th and 20th century is really a history of a realization that humans are not the only ones that make marks. The kind of invention of photography in the 19th century was revolutionary in lots of ways, but in part because it showed that nature could make images of itself. Nobody drew a photo of a flower. You simply expose the flower to certain chemicals and light. So the ability of machines or chemicals or even the environment itself to produce images of great complexity really decenters what it means to be creative and what it means to leave a trace and make a mark.
That's a wonderful place to finish the conversation. Thank you very much, Nick. I really much enjoyed that. I know I will certainly look at the work and a different perspective now. I hope our listeners will get a chance to see it. The Light and Darkness show is on for the rest of 2022. Nick, thank you very much for your time.
A pleasure.
Object Matters is recorded on the grounds of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. The Chowchak Wing Museum and the University of Sydney acknowledges the traditional owners of the land in which we meet and work, and we pay our respects.
Subscribe to Object Matters on your favourite podcast app and connect with the Chowchak Wing Museum on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. You can also subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter, News Extra, via our website, sydney.edu.au/museum.